I'm Mark Coppinger, and I teach aesthetics here, and apologetics, and ethics, and philosophy things like epistemology and metaphysics and so forth. And love it. I pastor a church in Evanston, Illinois, which is just next to Northwestern University, and I'm the student ministry director at Northwestern, and then I fly down here and teach. And so there are three of us who live off campus. One lives in Toronto, one in Charlotte, and then myself. And we fly in each week, and so it's kind of an interesting life. So I'm the Southwest Airlines poster boy and enjoy it. I taught at Wheaton College for, I taught at Vanderbilt for a year after I got my doctorate, and Wheaton for 6 years, and then God called me to seminary. And I thought, wow, I bet, since I know how to, like, read tough things and then study up and talk about them, that I could go straight into the ministry. And I've been a deacon, you know, so I've been around church and taught Sunday school. And besides, I'm married and I own a house and I have two kids and, like, what's this? And my father and father-in-law said, no, you really do need to go. And, oh, okay. So we sold the house, burned up the equity, went to Southwestern in this case, which was a very different school. I mean, Southern was quite liberal back then in the 70s or early 80s. And boy, they were right and I was wrong. I needed every bit of seminary. And I just thought I was, I don't know, beyond it or above it or something. And I was wrong. I needed it all. Can I take your picture? Would you let me take it? Has anyone ever taken your picture? Let's do that. We need to get that in. What do I punch here?
Push that button right there.
Okay. It's self-focusing and all that?
Yep.
Oh, man. Here, let's do. I tell you what. If you'll go over there and you'll be speaking to them, gesturing, you know, be saying, yeah, y'all turn around and look at him and then just have your mouths agape with astonishment. Now, look at him this way and you're lecturing to them and they're taking in. There we go. All right, one more. I got to frame this better. That's it. So this will be in the paper.
All right.
Okay. Thank you. All right. See y'all. All righty. So anyway, I did go, and I became a pastor, and off and on I pastored for 16 years, pastored in South Arkansas. But anyway, God called me to be a denominational servant. It's an old joke. Thank you for laughing. Appreciate that. And was the state director for Indiana and the PR guy at the Southern Baptist Convention Executive Committee and a seminary president at Midwestern. And had a great time. All along, I'm doing Army duty stuff. I got a ROTC commission in 1970 and did 2 weeks a year, did 28 years of that. And my last 6 years, I was with the Public Affairs Office, Department of Army, in the Pentagon on my two-week tours. And so in the SBC office and in the Pentagon, I was doing press relations, working with people calling in. Like, you remember when that TWA 747 blew up over Long Island Sound, and, you know, was it a missile, was it whatever? I was on the weapons desk at that time, and they would call every 10 minutes from the Washington Post or someplace and say, do you guys have all your missiles in the inventory, or what's the maximum effective range of a red-eye missile or a Stinger? And so I did that, but then when we went through the whole homosexuality thing with the Southern Baptist Convention, where we drew a line against churches that affirmed it, I was the PR guy for that, and that was exciting too because the press was not necessarily sympathetic. So I've worked with press a lot. I'm going to talk a little bit about working with the media, the nature of the media, and then we're going to look at a case of how to size something up. We're going to look at this Egyptian thing happening right now, and how when you know your stuff from seminary and the like, then you can get a better fix on it. Let me just quickly find out where you guys are from. Can you just very briefly say, you know, are you a student somewhere? Or are you on work release from the Kentucky prison or whatever you need to tell me? But what? Just where are you from?
I'm a student at Southern, but I'm from Oklahoma.
Okay, whereabouts?
Tulsa area.
Did you go to OBU or?
I went through the University of Science North Oklahoma.
Okay, in Tulsa or where is
that?
No,
that's in a small town south of Oklahoma City.
I did Army training at Fort Sill. I know Cash and Chickasha. I preached at First Baptist Chickasha. Yeah, and I was back at the airport after preaching there, and there's a guy there with a guitar case, and he's getting tickets, and his wife's there, and he said, Bo Diddley, on his deal. And I said, Bo Diddley? She said, yeah, that's Bo Diddley. And I said, you know, there was a song when I was in college, and it goes, Bo Diddley, Bo Diddley, where are you gone? Dun, 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 dun. And I said, who wrote that? She said, Bo Diddley. And I met Bo Diddley. So I have a Chickasha thing here. Amen. We're going to do that with each of you. I'm going to riff on your... No, I'm kidding. I know where Chickasha is. Yes? Very good. E-Town.
I'm from Springfield, Kentucky.
Okay. I'm in college right now. We're delighted you're here. We're delighted you're here. Yes. Okay. Springfield. Where's Springfield? Is it near E-Town? Or?
Yeah. In between Bardstown and
Danville. Okay, sure.
Lebanon.
Yeah. Beautiful country. I'll riff on four of you. I went to Fort Knox, did a three-week tour. And I stayed in a motel at E-Town one night while I was waiting to get into post. And I woke up to the morning show, and the theme song was my favorite song as a child, Teddy Bear's Picnic. Do you guys know that? Anybody know that song? Nobody? If you go out in the woods today, you better go in disguise. Yeah. And I thought, this place is my town. All right. Yeah, okay, let's go.
I'm from Murfreesboro, Tennessee.
Yeah. Yeah. Lived in Franklin many years. Great place. Yes. Oh, there's another one here. It was a black woman who was here in the previous thing. Good. My dad went there one summer to study John Dewey. But are you at Foggy Bottom? Okay. There's a stop on the metro or called Foggy Bottom. I think that's the coolest place to have a school. Yeah.
Oh, Cummins
Diesel?
Yep.
Yeah.
Indiana.
Yeah.
So I worked there full time, and this semester I'm a full time student at IUPUC.
Okay.
On the Indiana University side.
Excellent. It's IUPU. I is up where I was, but PUC is where C? Columbus?
Yep.
I'll be. Because they call it Ooey Pooey up there. What do they call yours?
IUPUC.
IUPUC. No, I don't know. But anyway, it's a great system. Great system. IUPUC. Okay. How about you guys? Very good.
I attend USI also.
Okay.
Now I'm from Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Oh, yeah. The original home of which NBA team?
I'm like an hour north of Fort Wayne, actually.
Okay. But you should know Fort Wayne trivia. It was the Detroit Pistons.
Yeah.
They used to be the Fort Wayne something-something Pistons way back, but good place. Yes.
Youth pastor in West Jefferson, Ohio.
Very good. Ohio State. Who did they kill or get killed by in the bowl games? I forget.
Well, they beat Arkansas.
They beat Arkansas. That's right. Oh. In basketball? Okay. I work at Northwestern. We lose to everybody. We and not all. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I graduated from
University. Oh, really? Okay. Really? I mean, you are now, or you did there at American? Wow, very good. Excellent. Yes? Okay, good deal.
I'm from Waterloo,
Iowa. Yeah. Yes, I've slept in Waterloo. I slept in Waterloo, Iowa this last summer. I'm not making this up. We have a bike team that goes across Iowa on Ragbri. I've done it 7 times. And we stayed at Ted Key's house, who was the president of the Iowa Baptist Convention in Waterloo. And everybody else was camped down by the casino south of town. And that's where you had the Fighting Sullivans, right? Those 4 guys or 5 guys who died on one ship or something. Great, salt of the earth place. Wow, okay.
I'm from Fairfax, Virginia, and I go to the Nova Annandale.
Good deal. I was once approached by a church in Fairfax Junction. Is there a Fairfax Junction? Fairfax
Station.
Station, not Junction. It's an old church. What is it? It wasn't Temple. It wasn't Temple. It was. I'll think of it later. But yeah, beautiful place. Wow. Okay.
I'm originally from Wisconsin, but fairly recently graduated from Boise.
Okay. Because you look familiar. You've been around.
Yeah.
Well, yikes. You know, when you have Alzheimer's, it's just thrilling if you recognize a face. All right. And this is the head of our military fellowship on campus.
Yes.
And this is.
Yeah.
Right. Very good. Great. And what famous architect has ton of stuff at Oak Park. He's from Oak Park. Frank Lloyd Wright. Lloyd Webber wrote Jesus Christ Superstar. But that's a different Lloyd. There are a lot of Lloyds around here. But he probably built some buildings, too. All right. Huh? Wow. Well, I saw one of those down in South Arkansas once, but it wasn't. Yeah, like the Roby House or something like that. I think that's it. Good. Well, what I do, I teach a part of is Christ and culture, where we just mix it up with everything, and everything is our subject. I mean, whether it's like, you know, YouTube or the price of corn in Ottumwa. I mean, it's we talk about everything under the sun because it's all under God's sun, and we connect up with everything. And one of the things about connecting up is connecting up with the press. I'm going to give you about a dozen things that I've learned through the years working with the press, observing the press, and the media. We talk about the mainstream media. Sometimes it's like the MSM, you know, that sort of thing. And when I was a kid, it was essentially ABC, NBC, CBS. They owned everything. It was Life magazine, Look magazine, Time magazine, Newsweek. And they pretty much had a lock on the nation's thought. And now it's just exploded. And just some guy with, you know, Wiki this or Facebook that can start a revolution in Egypt. And, you know, and the next thing you know, even the National Enquirer is unseating. Who do they? John Edwards is the one they pretty well destroyed, you know. I mean, it's just everywhere. And some guy can just have a little cell phone or, you know, a little smartphone, and boom, the next thing you know, he's playing on Fox. I mean, it's just incredible, the media that's out there. And it's a very promising time, very dangerous time. But you're a journalism major, so some of this will make sense to you. But let's just race through some sort of observations I've taken. First, the old thing, if it leads, it bleeds. You know, it's the old thing about if the dog doesn't bite anybody today, that's not news. If the dog bites a man, that's kind of news. If a man bites a dog, that's big news, you know. And so there's no headline that says, 100 planes land safely in Louisville today, you know. It's like it's the one that crashes and burns that gets the coverage. The same thing about the coverage of the church and of the seminary. When I was working at the SBC, the religion writers would call me every year from the different papers like Gail White from the Atlanta Constitution or Kathy Grossman from USA Today or what have you, and they'd say, okay, what are you guys doing this year at the convention? And they would call all the denominations because they had a limited budget. They weren't able to go to everything. And so, you know, they'd call the Nazarenes and the Methodists and the Episcopals and the PCUSA and the PCA and the Catholics. And so I would say things like, okay, on Tuesday night, we're going to have a prayer for spiritual awakening and we're going to suspend the regular programs and just get on our face before God and ask for His touch. And they say, okay, fine. And say, on the weekend before, we're going to knock on doors and share the gospel. Yeah, okay, whatever. And then I say, oh, and then on Wednesday afternoon, there's going to be a fist fight in aisle 3. Wait, slow down, you know. All right, how do you spell that? You know, because there was the excitement. They love conflict. And actually, I would have to say a lot of them just love for the church to make a spectacle of itself. So now, if you get all bent out of shape, if they do that, then you're going to be perennially bent out of shape. Just understand that's what really lights them up. And every once in a while, I'm thinking if the Courier Journal ever runs an article to say enrollment is up at Southern, students graduating at record number, you can't get an article like that, even though it's glorious. It's going to be like, you know, faculty member gets drunk, backs over a dog, or something like that. That will be front page. Well, that's kind of what you're working with. They have another quote they use sometimes, and it's like, afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. Kind of that counterculture thing. It's a little bit of that Watergate thing, you know, bring down the high and mighty. You know, it's Mubarak today. It's going to be George Bush next week or something like that. Look, there's something to be said for puncturing the pretensions of the pompous and the comfortable and to lift up the downtrodden, and that's kind of noble. But if you just use that as your standard, then it's sort of like, okay, like pedophiles. Well, are they afflicted? Yeah, they're having a tough time, so let's stand up for them. And the comfortable families are like traditional Christian families that are like stable and so forth. So let's afflict them a little bit, you know. You turn out to be counterculture, which works if the culture is rotten, but if they're good things. So I think in some respects they're kind of relativistic and they don't fully appreciate just the splendor of Christian flourishing and health. But again, if you like pass out, see, Jesus didn't go around like, you know, oh, I can't listen to that, la, 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 you know, I mean, or like swooning every time some bad news happened. No, he understood. He was one who knew the times, and we can know the times. And now, here's the hard thing to do, I'd say. It's just to be cheerful the best you can. You know, you may know they're trying to get you and trying to find that gotcha quote or trying to make a spectacle of you. But, you know, don't be astonished, and you'll kind of shock them by your cheerfulness. Look, when I became the SBC Executive Committee PR guy, there was a New Baptist Press head, and we flew in, Herb and I flew into Washington, rented a car, and we went up the East Coast and met every religion writer we could. So in D.C., it was U.S. News and World Report. It was Jeff Shaler there. It was Laura Sessionstep at the Post. It was Larry Witham out at the Times. And Kathy Grossman, USA Today. And then we were at the Baltimore Sun, and we were up at the Hartford Current and the Providence Journal and the, goodness, every Baltimore, I mean, Boston Globe and the like. And as we met these people, you know, we had a tendency, we were the new rednecks, the conservative resurgence, standing up for inerrancy, and we thought we were going to get smacked every time. But you go in cheerfully and positively. So we kind of were nervous going to meet Kathy Grossman at USA Today. She was right there at the Rosslyn stop at what's it called? Not Garnett, I'm trying to think, the publishing company. It'll come to me in a minute. And she was Jewish. And I thought, oh, she's really going to be cheering for the conservative Southern Baptists, you know. And she did. And she said, I know what you guys are doing. She said, I'm with a family of Jewish family that meets with other Jewish families to keep our traditions alive. You know, we spin the dreidel and have Passover. And she said, I know what you conservatives are doing. You're trying to conserve your traditional faith. And she said, I appreciate that. And we're like, well, okay, you know, like, she likes us. And we've had a relationship through the years of 20 years now, and she'll call me about once a year or twice a year to ask for a commentary. You remember when Obama was, so to speak, debating McCain at Saddle Creek and Saddleback and talking about their faith? She had, I think it was six of us, like, live contributing. It was kind of like live blogging. I don't know if it went up directly or she drew on it. And when somebody has this mock intelligent design thing called Flying Spaghetti Monster, she'll have me pitch in, or she'll have like six Catholic study Bibles and send them to like six of us and we review them. And she just does stuff like that. Jeff Shaler, I found out at U.S. News, his daughter went to Wheaton, where I taught. And so when we went to the Salt Lake City Convention and went witnessing in Provo and Ogden, Jeff shows up. Baptist witnessing in Mormon country door to door. That's an interesting story. And Jeff followed me with a cameraman. They flew in from Montana. And so my wife and I got our pictures in U.S. News and World Report, a couple of them, witnessing to Mormons because I was friendly with Jeff Shaler, not because he was always friendly to the conservatives, but, and then Laura Stepp, her dad was a Methodist preacher in Northwest Arkansas, and we compared notes on Arkansas. Even though you read their stuff, don't necessarily get your back up. But just be as friendly as you can, as amiable. When I was the PR guy, a funny thing happened across the street at Lifeway, at Sunday School Board. You know, Hank Williams Jr. Records Monday Night Football theme, you know, are you ready for some football? You know, that kind of thing. And then it's beer this and beer that, and they're singing, come on, kickoff. Well, he rented the studio at Lifeway to make one of his ads. They rent it after hours sometimes to just supplement. And so, basically, they're making a beer at the Sunday School Board. And anyway, this Tennessean had the time. You know, that's the kind of thing they love, all right? And it was everywhere. But instead of getting our back up and like, you know, you son of perdition, you know, how dare you? So, like, oh, wow, you know, okay. And I wrote a silly little letter to the editor and kind of laughed about it. But then I did say, but, you know, the fact that it is a story shows that we are not easygoing about inebriation or something like that. But you kind of keep it cheerful. When I was a pastor, we printed our stuff out. We sent our order of service out, and they called one day and said, we just are setting the type here. Could we call Paul Harvey and turn this in? Here's what happened. I was preaching through Proverbs, and I was doing topically, you know, like friendship and speech and stuff, and the first topic, I think, was adultery. because it was A. I don't think there was like aardvark or Aaron. It was like adultery, you know. And my music minister had chosen Why Not Tonight for the invitation hymn. And it's like, oh, no. And they wanted to send it to Paul Harvey, and I said, okay, we always enjoy it, you know, when others have bloopers, and so go ahead. And for about a year, every time I ran into somebody from out of town, they are you? Yeah, we're the ones. So that was fun. But instead of getting all wounded and huffy, you just sort of cheerfully tell your thing. Own who you are. Don't say, oh, no, we offended somebody. Okay, no, we didn't really mean that. No, be who you are, but be cheerful about it and be interesting, and they'll come back to you. I will say this. When we were looking for alternatives to Why Not Tonight, it was tough. Softly and tenderly, you know, I surrender all. I have decided. We found something. It could have been Joy to the World or something. I don't know what it was, but learn to speak in sound bites, in a sense. Have something. A lot of times you just say, hey, can I just take a minute and get back to you? And then you think about it just a second, and then you can email them something because you're choosing your words. Some of them are very kind to dress up your quotes if you're ungrammatical. You know, others are not. They'll just let you blow it, and they'll just put sick in there and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, be as friendly as you can, even knowing that they may be coming after you. By the way, one thing I've noticed, familiarity breeds contempt. It's a funny thing, but you would think that the Protestant writers in the South would be friendlier than the non-Protestants in the North. But in my day, Helen Parmley at the Dallas Morning News and Gail White at the Atlanta Constitution, and even Greg Garrison at the Birmingham News, those guys, you had to watch your back. I think they were so tired of Baptists or something, they were always looking for a way to poke them. I don't know what it was. But Ari Goldman at New York Times, or Michael, who's Jewish, and Michael Hursley at the Sun-Times, Catholic, they treated us with respect. I think we were kind of like an aboriginal group to them. You know, it's like they're writing about the people of the Gobi or something like that. And these are interesting people. We must treat them as a people group or something. But sometimes you're surprised by the treatment. One thing that, do you remember in the Bible where there's that, I think it's in Acts, it says, or maybe in one of the Gospels, I'm sorry to be blank right now, but, you know, he says, look, when you're hauled before the authorities, it's Acts, you're going to know what to say. You know, you're like, oh, but you'll know. It's amazing how God provides you that statement, and they'll call you wherever you are. You know, you may be on a panel or you may be whatever. We had a study from the Home Mission Board, precursor to the North American Mission Board, back in the early 90s. And it was like a map and a bunch of tables showing where the lost people were concentrated in America. I don't know if you've ever seen that. But they had a formula, the percentage of non-church people who were lost, 100, you know, percentage of Catholics who were lost, percentage of Methodists who were lost. They had this secret formula, like Coca-Cola, and they converted it. And the map showed real bright red where there was a concentration, they thought, of lost people, and then it shaded through orange and yellow to white. And anyway, this guy who worked in the evangelism department at Alabama thought this was interesting, so he told the Birmingham News, hey, look at this, you know, we're looking for, well, they looked at Alabama, and it basically said half of Alabama's going to hell. I mean, that's the headlines, all right? That's how they go. And they had funny headlines. AP picked it up, went all over the place, and it was like sticks and stones will break my bones, and sticks is spelled S-T-Y-X, like the river Styx, and so forth. So there's this poor man's Oprah show called Bertice Berry, and it was out of Chicago Public Television. And she called, and she said, we need to get you up here, you know, somebody from the SBC to defend this or talk about it. Boy, nobody wanted that job. We passed it all around the office, and I got, you know, let Mikey eat it, and I was the guy. So I go up there, and we had a panel. We had a professional atheist who has his own atheist TV show. We had a black Pentecostal pastor from Chicago, a liberal theologian from Loyola, and this guy from the Christian Council of Christians and Jews. You always see him on TV. It's like Rabbi Yekiel Eckstein, and he's with some poor little Russian woman, and he's trying to get money to bring her to Israel or something, if you've ever seen that guy. So, yeah, he's on a lot. So there we are. We're the panel. And they start with me, and the camera's right on me. It says, this man says half of you are going to hell. I mean, that's, you know, like, welcome to the deal here. And then we met the others. By God's grace, the Pentecostal preacher was really legalistic, And he said women who wore pantsuits went to hell. So I looked moderate. That kind of helped a little bit. And like I wore tweed instead of like shark skin, so I looked professorial for the camera. I mean, just being silly. But it was really raucous. And she said, "All right, how many of you think you're going to hell?" I mean, hands are shooting up all over the place. It was kind of like, "Ha ha ha, we're bad, and who's this Pharisee?" And so she pressed, and finally she just said, "You know, are you saying, you know, these people are going to hell?" And I basically said, "Look, I just go by what the Bible says." But about 4 minutes earlier, Chuck Kelly from New Orleans Seminary said something in passing. He said, "There's one thing worse than being lost, and that's being lost and no one's looking for you." And he said, and that came to me just boom right there. And I said that, and Southern Baptists are looking for the lost. There was a sea change in the room. I mean, it's just as though someone had messed with the thermostat, and it just changed. And there was a greater respect and tenderness toward me. And it wasn't my cleverness. It was that God gave me whatever. So you're thinking, sometimes we do this with terrible diseases. I could never face having cancer. Well, you don't have to right now. But when it comes, or whatever, it could be the loss of a child or firing or whatever, you'll get the grace. And you'll get some grace when you deal with the media. So just be prayed up. Know your stuff. When I was called at the SBC, what's your position on digging up ancient bones to put a freeway in? Like, I don't know that we've addressed that exactly, you know, but I go back to the resolutions and I check here and there and I try to find things in the ballpark. Sometimes you say we don't have a position. You sometimes, well, that's a little bit like something we said in 1963 in Resolution 4. You know, a lot of people just don't know the difference between Abishag and Ashkelon, and that's one reason you come to seminary, that you know your stuff. I ate at a little Greek restaurant last night on Frankfurt, and they were really Greek, and I said, Greek, you know, Lagos, Probaton, Brephos for baby. No, it's not Brephos, it's like Minna or something, or Mora, and so we disagreed, but we're having our Greek moment. You learn so much stuff up here that you can connect up, and you have so many resources. It's just a dream. Be wise as serpents. When I worked in the Army Public Affairs Office, U.S. News wanted to interview this general about a new interstate exit to go to North Fort Hood, Texas, down by Killeen, Copper's Cove, in that area. And it cost a gazillion dollars, huh? Well, it was like a pork barrel, you know, gazillion dollar thing, and they were prickly about it, and there was pushback. And so we had what we called a murder board. And I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but a murder board is where you get people in the room to, in a sense, try to murder the guy who's going to meet the press with questions. And we had sergeants. I was a lieutenant colonel. We had different people. And we would just bombard this general with impertinent questions, probing questions, insinuating questions. And after we worked him over, he was tuned up, and then he could go in. It was to make him as wise as a serpent, even though his manner was as gentle as a dove. And so part of it is just to be tuned up. One of the things we learned in the military is that when you staff something, you don't just bring problems, you bring answers. So like I was a logistical staff officer, and I knew not to go to staff meeting and say, "Oh, General, we're out of ammunition, you know, no more M60 ammunition. Ain't that bad? Let's just eat worms and die." No, I would say, you know, we're out of M60 today, but I think if we switch to range 4, and I've already checked with them, then we can do mortars today and this, and then we've got a shipment coming in from Anniston, and we can do it tomorrow. Or why don't we do this and this and this? So you offer solutions. If the press is fumbling it, don't just beat up on them, but suggest something. George Cornell was the chief religion writer for AP, and in the whole SBC controversy, he was saying it's the fundamentalists against the moderates. And, you know, the fundamentalists were the inerrantists. And it's like, wait a second, that's the raw word, you know? It wasn't always, but... And, in fact, the AP style book said don't use the word fundamentalist to refer to someone who doesn't use it for himself, because it connotes, you know, anti-intellectualism and meanness or whatever. And so I said, look, George, fair is fair. If you're going to use the raw word for one group, use the raw word for the other. Make it the fundamentalists versus the liberals, or the moderates versus the conservatives. And he went with the latter. He said, I think you're right. So I didn't just, you know, criticized him. He's dead now, and I've thanked him before he died, but it was a very gracious thing to do because he was a powerful writer. But he said, oh, yeah, okay, I think we can do that. And it lowered the temperature in the room. By the way, when we had two churches in North Carolina, I don't know if you guys, are you guys really hot and stuffy? Is it crazy? Let me crack this just a little bit. Can we tinker with it? These never connect up to anything, you know. I had a friend at Wheaton whose dad built motels in Texas, and he said, we put these in every room, but they didn't connect to anything. And so when they complain, then the guy comes in, tinkers with it, and the guy says, thank you. And, you know, it's kind of like the placebo effect. But that's just that part of Texas, wherever that was. These, I think, connect somewhere. Anyway, two churches in North Carolina essentially affirmed homosexuality. Now, I don't know a church that would not welcome a homosexual. I mean, mercy. We're all sinners, and we all need the gospel. But these churches, one married a homosexual couple, and in another case, they are licensed to preach a Duke Divinity School student. And the convention said, that's really not, you know, what a Southern Baptist church does. So it took 2 years to amend the Constitution to say that churches which affirm homosexuality are not in friendly cooperation with the convention. Well, boy, it was like Chernobyl in the press. You know, we had a clipping service, and we just were inundated with stuff. Some people were saying, oh, no, this is a PR disaster. Have you ever heard that expression? It's a PR disaster. Like, oh, they know what we're against and not what we're for, and they're defining us by a negativity. For one thing, we didn't bring up the issue. It's not like there was this planning meeting in 1978 or something that says, we have got to make this the decade of homophobia or something. No, it was just the whole agenda was rocking along. And so as it came, we drew some lines. And they kept saying it's a public relations disaster for the convention. You're so, you know. And I'm thinking, you know, actually the church is a public relations disaster if it's doing its job right. You know, I mean, honestly, they killed Jesus. He said, look, if you want to be more popular than me, you know, good luck. I mean, obviously what we say is quite offensive. It is really offensive. I don't mean you go out of your way to be offensive. Just preach through Romans, you know, preach through whatever. Genesis. You know, you'll start with Richard Dawkins calling you an idiot, and, you know, you'll jump to Romans, and then you've got the log cabin Republicans or the, you know, the Rainbow Coalition. Not that, that's a different group. Whatever the gay thing is. And then if you get to the judgment and Revelation, then you're going to have the universalists hating you. I mean, it's, look, when we started, I was the founding editor of a journal called SBC Life, and you see it around occasionally. And to plan it, we went to a show in D.C. in New York called the Folio Show. Folio is a magazine about magazines, which is really cool. And maybe there one day will be a magazine about magazines about magazines. But this is about magazines. And they trained us how to do a magazine, like the difference between coated paper and newsprint and tabloid and broadsheet and all this kind of stuff. And one of the things the guy said is, you've got to decide if you're going to be a magazine with edge or without edge. He says, that's a dividing line. Without edge, you're generally not offensive. You're just kind of a happy talk magazine. So it's like Reader's Digest or Saturday Evening Post or Martha Stewart Makes a Wreath or Christmas Ideals or something like that. And then the other is something like National Review or The Progressive or The Nation or something that has edge, has opinion that can offend. And it occurred to me there, the Bible is a book with edge. It's a very edgy book, and people who treat the Bible as if it's not, it's just all kind of happy talk and warm feelings. It's like, it's kind of like Nerf church. Have you ever seen, you know what Nerf balls are, where you got this little foam bat, little foam ball? You can play baseball in the living room around Hummel figures with Nerf equipment. The problem is the church is properly hardball, and you can't play it in the living room without something getting broken. You don't go out of your way, but it is the Bible has power to offend. So don't go out of your way to offend, but do church and then own it when you do it, and preach it and then own it. Now, what they do love, I will say this, except other than conflict, they love social ministry things. So Saturday Evening Post contacted us and said, we'll do an article and you can buy off prints and we'll have this symbiotic relationship. And one thing we did was feature the work of disaster relief. And it got kudos everywhere. I mean, the New Yorker magazine did something. You know where the tornado happens or Katrina happens and then all the retirees with the yellow caps and the vans in the kitchens come in? That's good stuff. And so we do that. So you can celebrate those sorts of things at all. Also, when I was in the military, we studied something called The Art of War by Sun Tzu. And one of the rules he said was, war is like water running downhill. When you go downhill with water and it hits a boulder, it doesn't go bonk, you know. It hits the boulder and goes around it and continues to find its way down the hill. And it may very well be the case that if you have a good story to tell, or you have an important criticism to levy, then you're not going to get it in the Chicago Tribune. But, you know, we have found today there are just all sorts of outlets. I mean, there was a school in Manhattan. I think actually Jackie Kennedy went to it. And there was a Christian, young Christian girl who went there, and they were going to have a day of silence for all the gays who had been silenced or something. So it's an enforced day of solemnity about the plight of gays, and you have all these little kids, grade school kids and so forth, and it just seemed like, come on, you know? I mean, I think I can hear them, you know? But at any rate, they came to me. I work for a website based in New York, funded by the retired CEO of American Standard Corporation, and I got a call. Can you maybe write something that we could send around to the parents to encourage them or to say to the principal, come on now, back off, you know? I mean, let's not force people into this. And it turns out American Spectator picked it up, which is a very conservative magazine that came out of Indiana originally. Bob Turrell was there. He was on C-SPAN book TV or something today. And they ran it. And so there are many, many outlets that you can find. So if not there, then go here. And if not there, go here. It's amazing how much is out there. Now, not only are you looking for outlets, I want to encourage you to be promiscuous readers. Now, that sounds bad, like I'm telling you to read naughty things, but that's not what it is. I sent something to the Washington Monthly to an attorney friend in Arkansas once to highlight an article. He wrote back this note. He says, I see that you're a promiscuous reader. And I was wounded for about 3 years until I realized that that's a quote from John Milton, and it means that you read widely. I thought he meant you're reading things you shouldn't be reading. I thought, Washington Monthly? I mean, you know, it's not evangelical, but hey. But read, have periodical friends and acquaintances. I just force myself to read things that I don't necessarily like or know nothing about. I don't know much about or didn't know much about business or whatever, so I just subscribe to Forbes or Business Week or something like that, or Fortune, just to figure out. And I, being extremely white, thought, I don't know what it is so much to be black. So I would read assiduously Jet magazine and Ebony and Essence. And when I'm getting a haircut, as if I need a haircut, I'll pick up Vibe and read it and see what Chris Rock has to say about this or that. And if I pull off at a rest stop in Indiana, I'll pull that free thing and get the Trucker's thing about Trucker's Chapel and that little thing that looks like a baseball bat and you can hit your tires with and see if they work and where to get a good fried shrimp, and I'll just do Truckers, you know. And if I'm sitting in the bus station in Louisville making a run up there and I got nothing and there's a refrigerator ad on the floor, an insert, I'll pick it up and get acquainted with refrigerators. If you're liberal, read National Review. If you're conservative, read Sojourners or The Progressive or The Nation. If you don't know anything, look, go to a doctor's waiting room, and if there's something about Food Service Preparation magazine, pick it up, and you'll realize about, I read an article about plate coverage, that if you slice the meat thin and spread it out, it looks like you got more meat, and parsley's a filler, and I think that may have been where I learned you weren't supposed to initially eat parsley. But if just read, you know, be a reader and challenge yourself. I remember Pauline Kael was the film writer for New Yorker magazine. And when Jimmy Carter lost big time to Reagan, just got killed in the presidential election, she was just nonplussed. And she's like, well, I don't know anybody who voted for Reagan. Well, duh, you live in Manhattan, maybe Upper East Side. You know, there is an Omaha, you know. Don't just be insular. Couple of other quick things. We had a clipping service at the Southern Baptist Convention. We had one in the Army, too. That every morning in the Pentagon, they have a thing called Early Bird, and it's like everything that's been said about anything in the military the previous day. And we had a clipping service. You know, you can hire one. You pay them a down payment or a basic thing, and it's maybe $2 a clip, and they will send you everything said about you in the press. Yours might be thin at this point. I don't know. But we used the same service Michael Jordan used up in Chicago. And we would get about 35 clippings a day. And in many cases, we realized they just didn't have a clue what they were talking about. They thought that if someone was a Baptist and he lived in the South, he was a Southern Baptist. And so sometimes we'd have... They did this in the early church, you know. They would say, those guys are doing incest. Well, what do you mean? Well, I just all brother, sister, this, and everybody's a brother and sister, and then a brother and a sister go home and go to bed together. Well, no, she's my sister in Christ, but she's my wife. Oh, okay. And I heard they like eat dead people. They're cannibals, like something about eating the body of Jesus or something. Like, no, 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 no. And so a lot of what you do is just say, no, please. You do that in the Army, you know? They'll say, 13 tanks rolled into something, something square. Well, those technically weren't tanks. Those were armored personnel carriers, and that's a different thing. Or, you know, or you'll look at a movie, some guy will have shaggy hair, you know, and his insignia's here, and like, you know, and it's just like, no, no, get it right. You know, that's not where you put the colonel's thing. And so a lot of what you do is that. But anyway, the clippings are important just to find out what they're saying about you, and it's always quite surprising. I mean, they'll even say, so-and-so raised a Southern Baptist or an active Southern Baptist. It's like Brad Pitt, you know, just all kinds of crazy people. You just think, where did that come from? And I want to say this. Speech codes are a huge thing right now. This is the greatest threat, I think, to the church from the outside in America. It's political correctness and speech codes. And you see it in Western countries everywhere. There was a guy named Uka Green. He was a like 70-year-old Pentecostal pastor on an island off the coast of Sweden. And there are more cows than people on that island. And they were going to have this big gay day or something in Stockholm. And he learned about it like in November, and it was coming in March. And so God bless this guy. He worked on a sermon. He was going to preach a sermon about God's view of sexuality on that day. And, I mean, he worked on it for a while. And then he notified the local radio station that he was going to speak on this. Well, they let it out to the local gay group, and the next thing you know, he was sued or charged with defamation or hate speech, and they charged him, and he appealed. And to make a long story short, he became a little bit of a celebrity. The Polish legislature had him come address it, by the way, but it went to the Supreme Court of Sweden, and the funny thing is it was put out over the radio, the trial. And they asked him, well, what exactly did you say? And then he got to repeat the sermon on Swedish radio, and he was acquitted. But that's Sweden. You think they're liberal, but they were about to shut him down. Then Daniel Scott, a Christian in Pakistan, a mathematician, fled to Australia, and there he got a job teaching in Melbourne. And after 9-1-1, a church said, hey, you're from Pakistan. Tell us what Muslims do or think. And he gave a little talk at a church, and then somebody else picked up on it. And to make a long story short, they finally put some plant, Australian-looking, Anglo-looking Muslims, in his church, and they took notes, and then they charged him with the vilification of religion. And he was ordered to take out $75,000 in ads in two papers in Victoria State, apologizing to Muslims. He said, I'm not going to do it. I wasn't mean. I was telling the truth. It went all the way to the Supreme Court of Australia. And finally, he was exonerated. Mark Stein went through the grinder in Canada, a columnist, before their Human Rights Commission for hate speech. And he barely escaped. And I'm telling you, whatever the topic may be, in America we have apparently a new constitutional right. And it's the right never to be offended. And the press is playing gotcha every way they can. They are trolling for a misstatement or an awkward statement. They love to go big. They're thinking, maybe I'm Woodward and Bernstein, and I can bring down somebody and embarrass a president and, you know, be a hot potato and get the Pulitzer Prize. And what they're doing is they're helping to, I mean, like Bailey Smith was president of the Southern Baptist Convention. A reporter was sitting in there, and he was talking, in the course of a sermon, he was talking about our only right to come before God is through the shed blood of Jesus Christ. By virtue of that, we enter the throne room, so to speak. And he said, in passing, he says, God Almighty does not hear the prayer of a Jew. Now, he does hear it. I mean, he's omniscient. But he doesn't. There's not that relationship. Well, that went all over the place, and it was crazy. Jerry Vines, pastor of First Jacksonville, in passing, said that Muhammad was a demon-possessed pedophile. Well, boy, actually, he does. He had worries himself about whether some of the passages came really from God or something else. And in fact, Salman Rushdie, who was on the run from a fatwa forever, wrote a book called The Satanic Verses, where he's playing over those particular passages that were questioned. And then he did, I think, take a wife when she was 9, which would be considered inappropriate in Kentucky these days. So it was a slam-bang kind of quote. But you know what I'm saying? You'll say a million words, but little pictures have big ears, and they're waiting for that one to nail you, and then it's got you, and it's off to the races. And all kinds of people play that game. But the stakes are much higher today, because then they can attach a lawsuit, and the next thing you know, they can silence your pulpit instead of just saying you're a creep. And I'm just saying, speech codes are all over the campuses, and they're all over the country, and the press, in many cases, plays with that. So it is a very exciting time. Be prayed up, be thought up, right along, and be as friendly as you can. Be a happy warrior, so to speak. A quick word about Egypt. We could talk about coverage of anything. I mean, whether, you know, a plow sharpening contest in Peoria or the gay marriage thing or whatever. But in many cases, just as you find in the military, the press, they've just been given that right now, and they have to somehow cover it, and they don't have much background. They said one of the best ways to get a fix on how good the press generally is read an article about something you know a lot about and then see whether they got it right. And sometimes, like, whoa, you know, I can't believe they quoted her. And like, well, no, it's not this, and, you know, so forth. I mean, sometimes it's just a miracle that it is so good, given that they just have to pick it up, dissolve it, hit the deadline, boom, you know. And you're constantly saying, are you on deadline? Yeah, I've got to get something by 3. Okay, and they become experts on something like in 5 hours. It's a tough job. But here are things I don't think you're going to hear with regard to Egypt. You know, there are mixed feelings right now, but it's like excitement, freedom goes, everybody loves freedom. By the way, that's kind of a tautology. To say everybody loves freedom is like everybody loves to do what they want to do. Like, okay, but what are you going to do with that freedom? What do they do with their freedom in vast majority Muslim countries? Let's say they've got it now. You don't have this Mubarak with this heavy hand keeping the Muslim brotherhood down and siphoning off money and, you know, imprisoning. What happens now? Freedom breaks out and you have like a nation full of like joyous Muslims. Huh? Yeah, well, it could be that there's a vacuum where the guys are coming in. But there's one word. I challenge you. If you ever hear it in the press, email me at mcoppinger@sbts.edu. And it's the word dhimmi, spelled D-H-I-M-M-I, dhimmi. And dhimmitude, or the practice of dhimmi, is the Muslim rule that non-Muslims in Muslim-majority countries are second-class citizens. You know? I mean, what happens is, in Egypt liberalized under Mubarak. It used to be, if you're going to build a church or a steeple or an addition, you had to clear with the national government. Now they made it so that you just have to clear with the state government. Can you imagine if you're going to build a Sunday school room on your church in Columbus, Indiana, you have to get a sign-off from Mitch Daniels? Mitch would probably sign it, but I'm just saying, what's that about? Well, that's the liberal position. Second-class state and citizenship means, in many cases, that you can't openly evangelize. If someone converts from Islam, they could be killed in Saudi Arabia, or certainly with honor killings, you know, you disappear in Somalia. Very, very tricky. Afghanistan, just forget it. I mean, it's just tough, tough, tough. A lot of times they have to pay a tax called a jizra, and it's tough. So let's say still glorious stuff works out. Now, where are the Christians? Do they have total freedom? And the irony is they come from those countries to America, and if there's the slightest irregularity on getting approval for making a mosque in Villa Park, you know, Illinois or something, they all just turn into the ACLU and Thomas Jefferson and so forth. But 6 months earlier, they were accommodating the oppression of Christians. So if this glorious revolution happens, the Wiki, YouTube, Facebook guys all get it, and there's dancing and happiness and freedom and prosperity, where do the Christians come out? And that's not going to be an automatic thing. You know, it's freedom for us, not necessarily freedom for you. And then one of the other things they won't bring up is just the question of whether or not Islam is compatible with economic flourishing and with, you know, prosperity and freedom. And democracy, for that matter. Either it was Bernard Lewis or Samuel Huntington from Harvard who said that the entire manufactured output, exports, from like Mauritania to Bangladesh, dozens of Muslim countries, is less than that of Finland alone. There's something about the suppression of women, the suppression of dissent, you know, and so forth, even tribalism and the like, that makes it really tough for them to be prosperous even when there's not a tyrant. And so, like, okay, you got it. Now, are you, is this going to be Gaza? You know, or, now you got that. You know, how's that worked out for you? And so, but the question then, I think the most interesting thing about a nation is its religion. But you don't hear much religious coverage of what's going on here. I mean, for one thing, sometimes, and I know we're going to break in just a second here, sometimes I'll draw, like, the world up here and say, let's name every car that we can that originated in that country. We'll just do it without the map. Germany, car. BMW, Mercedes. Okay. England. Sterling, Bentley, Rolls, Jaguar, Mini Cooper. Okay. Italy. Fiat. Ferrari is Italy, yeah. Lamborghini. France. No, that's Germany. It's Peugeot, Citroën, Renault. Okay. Scandinavia, any of those nations? Volvo, Saab, you know those things. In fact, one Catholic theologian talks about the difference between a Lutheran car and a Catholic car. The Catholic car is like red and the top's down and you drive around fast, you know, and a Lutheran car is like box-like with side girders and anti-rust, like Mercedes and Volvo, you know, Northern. But then you have these cars, and then you have a lot of U.S. cars, and then you have, in the East, you have... Well, that's in India, a latecomer, but the big ones are Japan, where you have, you know, Mitsubishi and Nissan, it's Toyota, and then Korea, Kia, Hyundai, Daewoo used to be one. Yeah. Now there are other little cars surfacing, but how come some nations have? Why is there no Muslim car? Let's get one of those Algerians, you know, this year, you know. Why is there no animist car? Let's get an Inuit car. You know, let's get like a one from like called the Shaman or something like that. I would suggest to you there's nothing more interesting about a nation in terms of economics, politics, and so forth than and R&D and so forth than its religion. That's the heart of the nation. I'll even go farther. Let's just say kingdom come happens. And the Coptics, you know, the Orthodox Christians, 10% of the population in Egypt, surface, you know, and now, you know, glory be. It's okay. Hey, have you ever been in a nation that is a majority Orthodox nation? It's hard to do evangelical work there because they take it on themselves to be the national church. And some of us, after Ceausescu fell, we went into Bucharesti, and we met with legislators and ministers from the Romanian government and said, hey, here's the First Amendment. Wouldn't that be cool? Because when Ceausescu fell, the church came in, and the Catholics and the evangelicals were being mistreated with zoning privileges and so forth. There's no Greek car. There's no Romanian car. There's a kind of an interesting primitivizing effect when Orthodoxy moves in. I mean, there are some wonderful Christians who are Orthodox. But why is that? Why is it that predominantly Catholic South America and predominantly traditionally Protestant North America both settled about the same time by, you know, people like, well, the Pilgrims and Pizarro and, you know, I mean, they're colonizing guys. How come the flow is north? Catholics worry about this. Why is it that the predominantly Catholic lands are not as prosperous as the predominantly Protestant lands? And they talk about in terms of the sense of vocation or hierarchy or whatever, whatever, whatever. Why is it that Northern Ireland is more economically prosperous typically than Southern Ireland? Why do they build aircraft in Northern Ireland, not in Southern Ireland? And the Catholics wring their hands about this. What I'm saying is, we don't have to sort all those things out, but if you want to understand what's happening in a country, what the prospects are for long-term peace, for democracy, for prosperity, for economic turnaround, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the most important thing to look at is the faith of the people. And you read it in the press, and to say, well, Islam is not a good base to build a great country on. You can't say that. I mean, maybe some guy, you know, visiting comment, then anybody will rebut him and he'll go off in disgrace and never be asked to be on television again. But there's a real problem. There's a real truth. I mean, even the cool Muslim countries like Jordan with King Abdullah II, great place. Some of us have been to Petra and, you know, seen that thing in Raiders of the Lost Ark carved into stone. Now they're hacking on the queen. And Turkey has had a resurgence of Islam. And don't even bring up Mogadishu and Kabul and so forth. And can anybody say it's not really a great religion? It's toxic. It's not a religion of peace. 100 years after Muhammad died, they were 1,000 miles east in India, 1,000 miles west, almost on the brink of Spain, 500 miles north and south. And if it weren't for Charles Martel in France and Jan Sobieski on the outskirts of Vienna, then Europe would be Eurabia, and then you wouldn't have Paris and Rome. And now, see, that's very impolite. That's so offensive. How dare you say that? We're so multicultural. We're so politically correct. We're so sensitive. We want to immediately mention all our sins. Oh, the Inquisition, the Crusades, et cetera, et cetera. It's all equal. It is not all equal. And yet you can't say that. And so you just watch this little parade of coverage. And they'll quote the ones who are very sympathetic. They'll quote John Esposito and Karen Armstrong and others, and they won't dare touch Robert Spencer or Bat Yor and others. What I'm saying is you got to be wise, and you got to know your Bible. You got to know your church history. You've got to know world history. You've got to know the insides and outs of journalism to size it up. And then don't expect it to be wonderful. Rejoice when it is. But it's the world. It's the world out there. And it's interesting to work with. Keep your cheerfulness, but be sharp. And don't just pick up the bucket and drink it, okay? Because there's a lot of bad stuff out there. Comments, questions, anybody feel a sermon coming on? Rebuttal, a PowerPoint, a puppet thing? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, we're all lost. And by the way, my heart breaks for the Egyptians. I want to say I don't think like sweet. You know, they got trouble. I've biked from Luxor to Aswan, witnessing up the Nile Valley and sleeping in hotels for $2 a night and getting rat bites in bed and. Been to Egypt a bunch of times, and they've been so wonderful and gracious, and your heart aches. But I tell you, until Islam dies, you know, and to apologize. I mean, I taught at Wheaton, and oh, we can't be the Crusaders anymore, you know. Oh, so ashamed of them. They weren't tourists in Jerusalem, you know. I mean, it's just like, look, we've all done some bad stuff and the like, but Idi Amin was a Muslim. You guys have just killed 2 million in southern Sudan. Now you're killing the West, Darfur. You were the slavers. I mean, oh, my goodness, it's just crazy. Yes, ma'am. you had a question?
I wrote down, you said, "Why is the serpent?" What does that mean?
Yeah, it's scripture, actually. You're supposed to be wise as serpents and gentle as doves. And gentle as doves, that people don't need to watch their back around us, or, you know, for our treacheries or our double dealing or even our violence. In fact, Paul says, persuade people. We seek to persuade, not to threaten. But to wise as serpents, the notion is you're clever. I mean, the serpent even deluded Eve, of course. But there was that. How do I put it? Some animals are considered their qualities that are associated, like you old fox. You know, like, oh, she's just a dumb as a goose. You know, I mean, you know, or like, he's messy as a pig. That serpent is associated with a certain kind of guile and cleverness and so forth. So Jesus was this way too. You know, they would try to trap him in a question. He says, I know where you're coming from. Let me do this here. And that doesn't mean you disown who you are, but you don't let that guy play, name the tune, you know? And he would answer back with a question. But, yeah, it's just like, yeah, it's a funny deal. It's a Bible expression. And it just means a serpent is considered to be someone who has is very clever and has a certain amount of guile, I think. Good question. Yeah, it'd be like, be wise as a dolphin or something. You know, I mean, I remember Ben Franklin said, our national symbol shouldn't be an eagle. He's like a scavenger, you know, and kind of vicious. He'd make it a turkey. But I don't know, you know, like, you know, let's look at the turkey march. It just doesn't quite work. And some things are associated. I think we ought to be the meerkats, you know, like, or whatever they call them. All right. Well, guys, great to be with you.